Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Leon Strauss, Senior IT Auditor, DNB, which is the Netherlands Central Bank, President from 2010 into 2013 for the International Federation for Information Processing. Leon, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
Thank you very much, Steve. It will be my pleasure to talk to your audience.
Leon, you have this incredible background, so can you describe your prior job roles and projects and some key lessons that you wish to pass on?
Well, a long time ago, in my first job, I was responsible for introducing IT for administrative processes in a small company, a real SME of, let's say, 40 to 50 people. And that was a very challenging job. It was my first job ever. And my biggest lesson there was that if you are the only expert, which I was, you need to find a way to discuss and test your advice. I mean, you may think that you know everything, but it's always good to have a reflection on what you advise to your company. And this is a difficult challenge, especially if you're the only one in the company and are not part of a society, as I became later on. So that was my first job. One of the other lessons I learned in that one, by the way, was that since this company had no automation at all, you had to learn the administrative processes from the bottom. So you really knew how the process works. And what I found out later is that if you move to a company which has a higher level of automation, you start to learn tricks. You know how the process, how to handle the process without necessarily knowing how it really works and what is the logic and reasoning behind it. So that's maybe a little bit of a downside of IT, which I may come back on later in this interview. In my second job, I moved from 50 colleagues to 1,500 colleagues. And this means that you're not the general expert, but you have to focus on a real small part of the field. So you become an expert. You learn a lot more in detail, which is good to specialize. But you have to realize that you have to move quicker between jobs, perhaps, than when you're a general practitioner, because otherwise you will become really focused on a special area. When I started this job, I could choose between becoming a programmer and following a career path into the system development world or working in the field of administrative organization and internal control. I actually chose the latter one because there you would learn more about the organization and how it works. And this side attracted me more than the hardcore IT world at that time. And in my current employer, I followed actually the same route. I became an IT auditor in the internal audit department, which gave me the opportunity to learn the complete organization, to get to know the entire organization by moving around having different departments and processes as an object of audit. So my lesson for anyone is if you want to really learn processes and get to know your organization, try to find a way to have a job that offers you this possibility.
So it sounds like you would recommend an auditing role then.
Well, I've never regretted it. So it takes a little special attitude. You have to be you have to realize that you really have to check your colleagues. But if you have no problem with that and you do your job properly, it's a really rewarding job.
In your prior roles, what were the three most difficult challenges that you were not able to overcome at the time? And then what would you do differently now?
Well, I've been very fortunate so far. I didn't have that many challenges that I couldn't overcome. The major one was in my early career when I tried to convince management of a solution by presenting them only one solution. And I discovered quickly enough that that doesn't work because management needs alternatives. They need to be able to choose, which is something you can find in any theory book. But as is often the case, you learn theory only by practice. So that's why I found out you have to present different solutions. Other than that, I have never managed major projects, so I didn't have challenges in that area. And, well, I actually had a very comfortable life so far in that respect.
So, you know, you've been in the field for some time and you've made a number of significant contributions, in my opinion. So, during your career, what were the key disruptive forces driving change in your life, and how can we learn from your experiences?
Well, I've had two, well, if you can call it disruptive forces. One was in my very early career path, actually when I was still studying, because my career started studying biology, which is quite something different from IT. And the disruptive force there was that I liked the student life too much, so I failed too many exams. And I had to go to fulfill my military service first before I could continue my study. After finishing my military service, I decided to follow a completely different topic, namely business economics, which is completely different from biology. And the lessons learned from that experience is that don't be afraid of making a total change. Don't be afraid of failing. Just continue and find a new challenge. And never say never, because I once told a colleague of mine who was studying business economics, I said, that's something I will never do because it's too boring. And a few years later, I found myself doing exactly that one. The second major change was when I was working for Philips Electronics in the early 90s. There was a major reorganization going on because times were bad and the company was really suffering. And there was a major operation which was a cutback of, I think, about 40,000 jobs losses worldwide for the company. Although my position was not questioned, it started a trigger for me to think about my future. I was working for a couple of years for the company by then, and due to this reorganization, as is often the case, the attention for information security was decreasing. Not only the attention, but also the possibilities, the funding, etc. And information security had gotten my major interest at that point in time. So I started looking around for a new job, and that's when I moved from a consumer electronics company to a financial world, namely the Central Bank of the Netherlands. So the lesson here is, again, if there's a trigger, even if you're not affected, don't be afraid to use it as a starting point for your own next step.
In all of your current roles, what are the biggest challenges and their solutions?
What I found the major challenge, not only for myself but also for colleagues, is on the one hand to keep up with all the trends. If you look at developments in the IT world, but also in the internal control, in governance, in business in general, there are so many trends. And people are very eager to follow trends. Not necessarily a bad thing, because if you don't follow a trend, you may lag behind. On the other hand, if you follow a trend without really contemplating on what would be the benefit for your company or for your own position, you're following blindly a trend, and that's a risk. The second issue in this respect is that if you are inclined to follow a lot of trends, you're also inclined to forget about the trends that you've left behind, the trends that are not so hot anymore. If you look in my own field of information security, we've had major trends in terms of viruses, in terms of hackers, in terms of identity fraud. If you move on to a new hot topic and you focus all the attention on that one, that doesn't mean that the other ones have disappeared or have been solved to a satisfactory level. So that's, for me, in my current role, one of the biggest challenges. Keeping up with trends, trying to find solutions for these trends, but at the same time not forgetting about dealing with the old threats and processes.
Which do you consider to be your top three contributions in IT audit and security?
Well, since I'm not a real computer scientist, I'm not a researcher, so I cannot present any deeply scientific work on that one. For me, my contributions consist mainly of being active in computer societies and organizations like computer societies in order to encourage people to cooperate and to contribute to the best I can to promote research work, to promote topics topics and make people aware of what's happening. When I started becoming active in this, I was involved in a couple of working groups that really contributed to putting a lot of the topics on the map, saying we are addressing issues that are or are becoming very important at a time where most people didn't know about it. So that's my, let's say, small contribution to IT audit and security.
Can you briefly outline some of these areas in terms of the working groups and so on?
Yes. Well, one of them, which I may come back on later on as well, is we made an inventory of security standards. And most people, certainly in the industry, were not even aware of all the standards that were available. They didn't know which ones to choose, and they didn't know how to use them. So that's where we try to provide some guidance by a publication. It's a Dutch publication, but we have been trying to translate this into an international context. One of the products involved a description of security functions. What would be needed for somebody to be a good security officer? What kind of functions do you need in a company with respect to information security and IT audit? One of my earlier working groups addressed the issue of data communication security. So quite a variety of topics, how to draft a security policy, etc.
Leon, you know, you have this incredible background. You've got so much experience. And so I'd like to get your insights. For example, what are your top recommendations on areas like business continuity, crisis management, and critical infrastructure protection?
On business continuity, I would say prepare yourself for worst-case scenarios. Take measures based on different scenarios for different kinds of threats and think the unthinkable. Don't believe that worst-case scenarios are doom scenarios that never happen. They do. For instance, in the Netherlands, we are not very familiar with earthquakes. So you might be inclined to think, okay, I don't need to take measures against earthquakes. But nevertheless, they do happen. And if you're not prepared, even a small earthquake, which is barely noticeable, might cause damage to your computer center. If measures are too expensive to counter really bad threats, okay, you don't spend the money, but you have to realize and think about the consequences if such a case will happen. And you are at least prepared for that one. Concerning crisis management, my message is keep practicing. Whatever procedures and structures you have developed, they need practice. Make these tests, these exercises, as complex as the real world could be. My own experience has shown that you can have a series of successful tests in a smaller context and with limited threats. So you might be inclined to think, okay, I have everything perfectly in place. If you test your crisis management organization and procedures in full and to the highest level of your company, you will be surprised how many aspects work different than compared to what's written on paper. Especially strategic level of management might act in a way which is difficult to predict. So keep testing. Finally, the third topic you mentioned, Stephen, is critical infrastructure protection. Again, not per se from a purely technical point of view, but for me, the challenge is to identify the interdependencies of sectors from each other. If I take my own sector, the financial sector, as an example, but we're not the only one, we are depending to a large extent on energy and IT. These, in turn, depend on each other. Without energy, no IT. Without IT, no energy, basically, nowadays. But that's the obvious one. Now you've taken measures in terms of power generators on diesel. But what about the transport sector? If you need additional diesel and there's no transport available, you have a problem. So getting the cooperation and understanding of sectors amongst each other clear, that's one of the main issues as far as I'm concerned at the moment. And this needs an active involvement of the government, because many of these parties and companies, they have different interests, not in the last place commercial interests. So maybe they're not so eager to share their exact possibilities and vulnerabilities. So there's a party needed, like a government, which acts as an intermediate. But it needs to be an open-minded and willingness to share information. And naturally, if I take a step back to the IT environment, it definitely needs encouragement of continuous further research on technical solutions and on vulnerability.
Leon, you touched on this somewhat before, but if we can sort of go deeper, and that is if you can share your insights on the standardization in the area of information security.
Well, this is an interesting area. I've been involved in and following standardization for quite a few years. So actually, I'm in favor of standardization. However, like I mentioned before, I was involved in an inventory of standards early 90s. And we were amazed already at that time how many standards there were available. And there's a famous phrase, I've forgotten who it is from. It's a good thing that we have so many standards to choose from. This has only increased. And even if I'm a bit less directly involved nowadays, I still follow what's going on. And I'm amazed about the topics that are proposed for standardization. It seems that it has become a sort of an industry of its own to develop standards. And even if it's topics that you would consider, let's say, an area for good practices, to share views, but not for a strict standardization process, people still propose topics for standardization. And I'm not so convinced that this is a very good development. There are clear technical standards that need technical issues that need standardization, and they need to be evaluated, they need to be progressed, that's clear. But a lot of the areas where people want standards nowadays is has gone a bit too far in my personal view. If I take an information security standard, the ISO 27000 series, that has emerged from a good practice from industry. Very useful for many companies to share the knowledge brought together by a lot of major companies. This has been transformed into a standard, which was very helpful again. But what you see nowadays is that this standard is adjusted to specific kinds of industries. So instead of one general good practice, you end up with a couple of slightly different standards. And I'm not so convinced that this is the right direction to go. And it's also not so helpful for user communities, especially not if they cannot afford expert advice. So maybe it's a bit of a less positive view on standards than I had 15 years ago.
So I guess this even then ties into, and I'd be interested in this, like what are your views on the more important, broader business challenges and their solutions?
Well, if you take this standardization concern a little bit further, or maybe even a little bit back, the business challenges are sharing good practices. If we take the three topics we mentioned before, business continuity, critical infrastructure protection, there is a definite need to share experiences, to be a little bit open in what have you done yourself, what went wrong, what was a good solution, how can you learn from each other. There needs to be a little bit more openness in that area. And also between different sectors, between different disciplines. It's starting to sound like a mission I have, but it really is. So sharing information, that's for me a real business challenge. And getting the technical solutions in place, of course, is also a challenge, but there's a lot of people working on those. I don't have a real ready-to-use solution for that. It takes just a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of people who share the same belief.
So can you provide your predictions of future business IT trends and their implications?
Well, here is an area which is a little bit difficult for me because, like I said, I'm not a computer scientist, and what I see, for instance, in my IFIT community is quite a lot of interesting technical developments in terms of the field of artificial intelligence, cloud computing, even entertainment computing, which sounds not of interest to industry, but except for the gaming industry, but it is, because from the entertainment computing industry, a lot of things can be learned and used for other application areas as well. So future business IT trends, I have to pass a little bit on that one, because that would make me predicting something that's a bit beyond my expertise knowledge.
You know, we hear about the IT Millennium Development Goals. Well, how will developing countries achieve this?
Here they will depend a lot of the developed world. That's where we have an obligation to share our knowledge as well, and to do it in a way that developing countries can afford it, either by getting support from UN-type bodies, organizations, which are many in the world. So that's a good thing. This is really, I've been involved in an event called the World IT Forum for the last 7-8 years. And what I've seen there is that it really can be effective if you work together between the different parties: industry, research, developed world, developing world. So you have to set up a structure making use of the knowledge that is available in the developing countries themselves. Don't underestimate their capabilities, but make use of what they have available. The difficulty for these countries is, to a large extent, of course, financing. It costs a lot of money, and that's where industry partners are absolutely necessary. So there's quite a few ways to do it, but there's also quite a few obstacles. Money, I mentioned already. The other one is culture. I've organized this event together with a lot of colleagues in 4 different countries by now. Each country is different in terms of culture, in terms of finding out the best way to get ideas implemented, to get projects started, to get government convinced in investing in areas where it is most needed and most effective. And that's where we try to combine policymakers and practitioners, which is not so easy.
So I guess you talked about WITFORD and the World IT Forum, and that's sort of associated with the International Federation for Information Processing, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And you also touched on this whole aspect of industry and academia. Well, how can they work more effectively together?
What I've seen in the last few years is that there's already progress made in that area. If you look at certain industries that hire academics on a project basis, they have exchange programs with universities. So there is a trend in the right direction. Quite a few years ago, I tried to organize an event bringing industry to talk about what they would need in the area of information security, and bringing researchers talking about what they are offering. It was a difficult process. Researchers understood what industry wanted, but industry had difficulty to exactly understand and interpret correctly what research results could offer them. I think this is a trend that is slowly changing. In the Netherlands, we have for the last 3 or 4 years a research-funded project, which is called Sentinel. And one of the prerequisites of that program is that each project which gets selected and gets funded must have an academic component with a matching industry funding. So slowly, by encouraging projects like this, there is more working together. But it's a process which will take time. The bigger difficulty will be because then you have usually industry who is already engaging partly researchers. The bigger challenge will be to have the industry at large listen to what research has to offer, and interacting with the researchers in a way of indicating focus areas, topics of major interest, etc. And I think there we have a responsibility as computer societies, not only IFIP, but also the national computer societies, to try to organize events which still try to achieve exactly this interaction between the two.
You know, you talked about societies and the International Federation for Information Processing, IFIP, and so on. So kind of related to that, then, what can we do to foster international cooperation between disciplines and different types of bodies in order to achieve benefits for society?
Well, that's not so easy, because most of the societies, including my own, have a tendency to let's say, protect what they have and protect what they do. And 20, 30 years ago, that was fine. There were not that many societies. Whatever you did was successful, and there was room for all of us. What you see nowadays is that there are many more societies, many more groups, many more organizations trying to achieve the same goals. And there is a point where you have just too much competition. So the trick is to talk to each other and see how you can cooperate, organize joint events, join forces, because most of these societies are driven by volunteers. And there's only a limit to the number of volunteers that you can find and who are willing to spend quite some of their free time in working on this. So the challenge for all the societies, including the member societies of IFIP, will be find a way to cooperate in your activities in a way that the contributions of all are acknowledged, but you still have an efficient and effective calendar of activities. And this also reflects on cooperation with, let's say, other types of organizations. If I look at, again, the developing countries area, if there's dozens of computer societies or related organizations talking to possible funding mechanisms, that will be not very effective. If you join forces and you make it a big concerted effort, funding mechanisms might be more willing to support the work you're doing. But again, this takes time, convincing power, and willingness of these societies and organizations to be open for it.
I get the feeling that there can be a lot of fragmentation and sort of where the messaging creates confusion among governments and policy groups and IT practitioners and the general public when they see so many different organizations.
Yes, I'm afraid so. I can elaborate on that, but the simple answer is actually yes. And we've seen this, for instance, in Europe, where the European Commission, I think it was about 15 years ago, they said, look, if you want to do some, let's say, lobbying as computer societies or as computer professionals, if you have some advice, if you have some remarks on proposed legislation that will affect you, I don't want to talk to 20 societies. You organize yourself, you work together, and you come to us with one voice. And I think that let's say, a European Commission type of environment.
You know, you see this in the news about a global industry. So what does it mean that IT is the first truly global industry?
Well, IT is truly global in a few aspects, I think. Obviously, if you look at everything that's possible in terms of outsourcing. I mean, if you move your office or your programming department around the world, it doesn't matter. You can do that. There's labor force present. There's sufficient people who can learn the job. So it's no longer a prerequisite that everything is in your backyard. That's one aspect of global industry. The other one is that through all the communication mechanisms, the world is constantly, well, let's say, open. It's a 24-hour economy. If you try to follow the news around the world, you have to stay awake for 24 hours. So that's global in terms of outreach, with a few exceptions, of course, because we talked about developing countries who still are lacking part of the infrastructure to be part of it. But that's only a matter of time before these areas are also, let's say, part of the global industry. I'm not sure whether it's the truly first, but at least it is a truly global industry.
You know, you're the president-elect for IFIP and then will be president in 2010 into 2013. Can you talk more about the key initiatives for this International Federation for Information Processing, or IFIP, and what you hope to achieve while president?
Oh, definitely. IFIP has started some changes, some strategic initiatives a few years ago, and it is my goal to continue those and to make sure that the five-year strategic objectives are met. A few of those are continuing to present high-quality research work, because that's our origin as IFIP, academic research environment. We started in 1960, in 1959 with the World Computer Congress. And irrespective of all the other initiatives, for instance, what we are doing in an increased effort towards developing countries, we should not forget about our origin and should not lose this strong point of us. So making sure that the quality of our research and the community is guaranteed. At the same time, cooperate more with our member societies on this, who are also trying to achieve this. Another major goal is to be more active towards a couple of relevant United Nations bodies, like UNESCO and a few others. We are on the list. Occasionally we have some meetings, but this needs to be strengthened. We need to be cooperating more with these bodies, especially with a view on what we try to achieve for developing countries, because these bodies work on policy levels to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. We can try to contribute in practice levels, practical levels, and there needs to be a good cooperation between us. So that's another area where I'm going to focus on more than we've done in the past. We have a project going on which tries to promote the professionalism of the profession. How can you increase professional behavior, professional attitude, professional conditions to all those working in IT, either as a computer scientist or as an industry professional, to give your employer some kind of assurance that you are qualified for the job and that you are truly professional. So this is a challenging project, because like we discussed before, it's a global industry, but we have a lot of cultural differences and a lot of legal differences. So this is an interesting project going on. And another specific thing I would like to mention is that we would like to find a way to make the work that is being done in academic research and other areas accessible at no or low level cost for, let's say, the world. A developing country usually cannot afford to have subscriptions to all kinds of digital libraries with technical research work. That's an area where we try to also provide some means to do it. We have quite a few initiatives and challenges for the next few years.
Well, it sounds interesting. You know, you talked about research and developing countries and this idea of professionalism and making resources available and so on. That professionalism program, then, is that the International Professional Practice Partnership Program?
It is, yes.
Or IP3, I guess it's
called. IP3 is the name at the moment.
In your own home country, do you have plans in terms of IP3 at all? Or?
Well, we are still working on this. I'm definitely encouraging it. The problem is that there is a few initiatives which all complement each other. And we have to do a little bit of work to explain what's behind the initiatives and how they complement each other. Because sometimes, let's say, the outside world, if I may call it like that, is not fully aware of the differences between the initiatives, and they have a feeling that that's a competition. So they lay back and say, look, let's wait for the one initiative to emerge that we should follow. So we have to do some explanation in that area.
You know, you've got a remarkable background, as I indicated earlier, and a good long history of success. And as a result, you'd have your fingertips on what you'd see as the top resources that are out there. Can you provide your recommendations or what are great resources for the public?
Well, it depends a little bit on what you call the public, because what I've found is that resources, if you look at the computer science resources, digital libraries by our member societies like ACM, British Computer Society, IEEECS, they are really very valuable sources. But not all of the outside world has easy access to it. Even if you have, let's say, a reasonable subscription rate as individuals, usually individuals wait for their companies to pay for a subscription. But if I had to choose, it would be digital libraries like those that I would recommend, and to look into the scientific journals of your specific area. Usually they are supported by computer societies as well. So I really am very supportive of all the resources that are provided by the computer societies.
So I'm just thinking about the available computer societies that are in many countries around the world. And I guess as a resource would be the members of the societies. If people, you know, when you go to a meeting or a convention where you have an opportunity to share ideas and trade concepts and research and so on with your peers and others, your colleagues.
Well, that's definitely one of the benefits of being a member of a computer society, whether it's a national society or a more global like IFIP. The challenge for these societies nowadays is to, I've mentioned it a couple of times, but to cooperate, because when I attended my first conference, it was one of the few in my field in information security. But it was a large conference with many colleagues, with many aspects. That was 20 years ago. Now there are so many of them specialized in information security. You can go to a conference twice a week, which means there is a dilution of audience, of topics, and it's only very limited circles. So the societies have to find out what would be a good way of cooperating, what would be the goals of each event. If you aim at discussing with a limited group of highly specialized researchers, that's fine. Please go ahead. If you want to offer an opportunity for others to learn and to have the opportunity to discuss with colleagues they would normally not meet that easily, I think we are on a way that we have to think about how to do it, because it's not something that happens from itself at the moment. That was the case 20 years ago, but no longer at the moment.
You know, in your travels, you must come across events and people who have shared their stories or circumstances and other conditions that you find interesting or amazing or humorous and so on. Can you share some stories from your travels, from your work?
That's a good one. I've had a story in my own work environment, which is not so humorous, but it's still a bit surprising. We have created a platform in the financial sector which aims at being the sparring partner for the Dutch government in the area of critical infrastructure protection, because we found that it would be easier for the government to have one entrance for our sector rather than having to find out in 10 or 20 institutes who to call. Normally, setting up a group like that and getting a position that is accepted takes quite a long time. We started this group in January this year, and I was very much surprised that we have already been enlisted in one of the government programs with this group to continue the work. So that's in a way an amazing story in terms of well, like I've said earlier, think the unthinkable. Don't think too easily that it is too difficult, it will take too much time, it will take forever. Sometimes you never know. Sometimes you get lucky and you reach a result much quicker than you hope for. So that's a little bit of an unexpected outcome. In terms of humor, I have to apologize. I've not a real humorous story, or it should be the case that you never should underestimate creativeness of colleagues in terms of organizing an event and disappearing into thin air with the money. We've had a case long time ago where we trusted a volunteer, which you should do usually, but still, even if you work with volunteers, you need some control mechanisms, and we failed to do the proper control mechanisms. But somebody organized the conference, and after the closing session, the next morning, he had taken the plane and left the country. So there's a lesson, indeed, maybe not so humorous, but still a lesson that you have to trust people, but still you need some control mechanism, even in your volunteer environment.
Now we're going to turn the tables as we come to the end of our interview, and you know we've discussed a lot of topic areas, but I turn the tables by saying, gee, if you were doing this interview, what three questions or one or two questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, that's an interesting challenge, because I can think of a few questions I would like to ask, but if I would have the answers, I would not ask them. So what I would ask is, how would you motivate professionals, meaning both people working in academia and in industry, to devote part of their time to be active as a volunteer in a computer society or a society like IFIP? It's an increasing problem in finding sufficient volunteers to do all the activities. And my question would be, how would you motivate people to do it? The only answer I can think of is that by showing your products, be proud of your products, and be enthusiastic yourself. Just by being optimistic and enthusiastic about what you're doing, you can hope to convince people to share this enthusiasm. Otherwise, I don't have any arguments or incentives for people to say, look, this is something you have to do. A second question would be, from a society point of view, or maybe even from an industry point of view, would you give up part of your activities if someone else could do a better job? And I've mentioned it before in this interview, we tend to be protective of what we are doing, which means you stick to activities that may not be as successful as they once were, where other groups have assembled more volunteers to do the job than you have at the moment. So would you give up your activities in return for having more time available for new area? My answer would be yes, but there's always a but. But I would like to stay involved one way or the other, either by cooperating or by having a sort of a link to this new group that would take over. These would be two questions which I still hope people could react to the interview and give me some suggestions for the future.
So you're reaching out and saying, here are some possible challenges, and you're looking for crowdsourcing to get ideas.
Well, if possible, yes.
Well, Leon, we're indeed fortunate to have you come in today to do this interview, and we will continue to follow your significant global and historical contributions. You're having an impact, and you're having an impact on a planet basis. So, and we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audiences.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. It was my pleasure to do this interview, and I surely hope there will be some reactions to it.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Leon Strauss, Senior IT Auditor, DNB, which is the Netherlands Central Bank, President from 2010 into 2013 for the International Federation for Information Processing, or IFIP.